Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. I'm glad you're here. So, I'd like to start this week off by getting into some parenting stuff. It's been a while since we've had a parent-centric episode where we talk about the difficulties and the tensions that come with raising a new human. After that, I'd like to share some stories. And then we'll get into some nitty-gritty philosophy. I want to try to find the difference, the obvious difference, between abstraction and instinctual intuition. And I want to see what these concepts have to do with our own perception of the world and how we view ourselves in it. So I've had a pretty powerful parenting week. For any of you who know, my son has many challenges. He had a speech delay until he was about the age of 4 and has struggled in school because of this. He does not have his mother actively in his life and hasn't seen her in several years. And this causes a lot of trauma and the sense of absence and the sense of abandonment that comes with these situations can have a lot of ramifications. And I know this because I have clear sympathy for my son, not just sympathy, I have empathy, because I can relate, because I did not have my mother in my life either. And that feeling is still pervasive and poisonous in my conscience to this day. It's hard to feel like somebody doesn't want you. This happens in our human relationships all the time, and I mean like sexual relationships, that is, because whenever there is a breakup of some arrangement, you know, even amongst friends, usually one person wants it more and the other person feels at a loss. You know, mutual breakups do happen, but the sense of loss of not being wanted, I think, is a horrible feeling, and it bleeds into every aspect of a child and the adult that child grows into their life. And so my son has a lot of difficulties, and we have been in so many different therapies and different models and different strategies over the last 7 years. And of course, it all started with speech therapy because of the delay. But I've had my son in various different play therapies. He's been seeing an occupational therapist for at least 5 years now. He's been through a couple of them. We see a community organizer, which is basically like somebody who can give me resources and allows us to have a space where we could be together. So I've been trying all these different things. I got him an IEP. An IEP is an individualized education plan. And if you live in the United States or in a place that offers these, which I'm pretty sure it's offered anywhere in the United States, it's a government program that sees the child as having a disability. And so once somebody is recognized as needing the help, especially from a government source, you get more funding. And so then you have all kinds of extra interventions. And so this year he's had all this extra support. But we've still been taxed, you know, because he still has a hard time learning his existence and being in his mind. He's diagnosed ADHD and ODD. ADHD is the hyperactive, I'm sure most people know what that is, but ODD is oppositional defiance disorder, which is a breed of antisocial disorder. And it's basically just being very self-centered, basically. And sociopaths are antisocial as well. But ODD tends to be more of a pro-social behavior because it's not a manipulation of sorts of people or events or the environment. It's more so just an inability to hear the environment. And so one tends to take one's own advice and shuns anything else that's happening outside. So he's still learning, and we have our own difficulties at home. But unfortunately, in this world, we send our children out often, some people get homeschooled, but into institutions. And the first institutions are the child care centers or the baby takers. It's slightly different when you have an at-home babysitter, and when some person can actually afford a nanny and somebody who can really give time. But we have all these shoots that we throw our kids into that are like these little camps, really. There's so many children at these daycare centers, and there's not enough people to give one-on-one attention. And I know this because I worked at one, and my son grew up in daycare. And then you move from daycare onto school, which is a little bit more structured, and some people enjoy it more. I know I did. But if you have a difficulty being able to understand the schooling, and you already have a tension there, then being institutionalized from birth is a difficult starting place in the first. You can't just expect somebody to grow into a well-rounded individual in these institutions. And most kids are spending a majority of their time, especially during the school year, in an institutionalized setting rather than at home with the parent. And it's not even like there could be any other way to do it. As a single parent, I have to work so much just to support us. And so first and foremost, before being educational, school continues to be simply childcare for me. And I need to have this place where I can have him so that I have the ability to work and support us. And I know many other people are in my same exact shoes. So then you have the extra additional difficulties and the security that comes from needing to work and needing these places. And so over the last couple of years, my son has been suspended and he's already been expelled from one school. He's been asked not to come back to several daycares. And these are all wrenches that get thrown into the metaphorical bike tires of our family. And we've been trying hard to figure out how to socialize or help the behaviors so that he's more comfortable or something, so that he doesn't feel like he has to act so extremely in these institutions. And then I have an extreme reaction when I have to leave work and I have to go get him. And so my son and I have been stuck in this cycle of toxicity and aggression. And unfortunately, it's grown to the point that our relationship hurts. And it hurts me to know that. And that's part of parenting. And that's really the meat of why I want to bring this up today, is that in parenting, it hurts. And a lot of the times we feel negative emotions towards our kids. And that doesn't mean that the whole entire relationship is negative. It doesn't mean that we hate our kids. But it's part of parenting to feel these difficult situations. And we get into it. It falls into our laps, this tension in interpersonal relationship between us and our kids. You see, a big fallacy, more like, because it's highly illogical that we do as parents as well, is that we kind of adultize our children. And this was really easy to see back in the past, in the old black and white photographs, because 5-year-olds would be wearing suits, you know, and they look like miniature versions of their fathers. Or, and then the opposite side of that as well, on the other side of the gender role, with females and their dresses and all made up, you know, they're miniatures, really. This idea of being a child and having a childhood is almost a recent invention of our people, of our societies. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, children as young as 10 would have still been expected to work in the factories and to help support the family because of just the difference in lifestyle. So many things have changed because of industry and because of capitalism and because of modernization that we have an ability to have free time for the children. Whereas for most of human history, that was probably not even an option. So it's also respectable to notice the novelty of how new our parenting is. We're in a new modern age of parenting. And when it comes to advice, there's so many different types of advice on how to parent, and it changes so quickly. I have at least 20 different parenting books sitting on my shelf right now, and almost every single one of them contradict each other because nobody can agree on how to parent. There is not one set way on how to raise a child. And every child is so unique and so different that there's no method that you could use to standardize to every child. Even if you found one way that works for your kid, that doesn't mean it's going to work for another. So we have this new situation that we find ourselves in, and we're learning how to adapt. And ethically, for me, it does seem like the most practical thing to do is to have this nice childhood. You have an environment that's conducive for critical thinking, for creativity, for all these things that I like to talk about on the show, for unneeding, unconditional love. You know, you have an environment where somebody feels supported, you know, but still challenged. Doesn't mean they have to be working 12 hours a day in the sweatshop smelling glue. But we have this remarkable opportunity now to give this amazing start to our kids. And hopefully they can be just even more loving than any people at any generation. You know, modernization is evolution, it's change. We're moving into something new. And our kids are moving into something we can't even see. And that makes it even scarier. So what do I mean by adultize our children when we have our miniatures? I fall into this non sequitur all the time because in my head, I have such high expectations for Odin. In my head, he's amazing. And that's what we do. We have the best intentions and we have the best outlook for what we see our kids to be and what they're gonna be, you know. And some of us push our kids so hard to push them into that ideal that we made for them, that we bastardize their individuality. And so I have all these expectations. And what comes out of this adulting of our kids is this condescending need to ask the question why. And I do this all the time. You know, I'll see my son do something that does not make logical sense to my adult brain, but because he's a child, he has a completely different perspective and operating system. He's working on a completely different computer than I. And so I see what he does, and my brain jumps to, why did you do that? Why? What were you thinking? You know, which as a parent, when we do this, we're asking why, and, you know, the reason for the why might be honest. We might want an explanation, but we really don't. We want an explanation, but we don't, because we already know that we are upset and we know that we're disappointed by these actions. And most children are aware enough to see this disappointment. So we're really just throwing salt on the wound in a shameful way to inspire shame. And shame is a huge societal training tool that we humans always use on one another. Shame is used to enforce behaviors. We do it in almost every single social context. But when it comes to shaming our kids, which is part of parenting too, but it gets overused and it gets abused. And so part of this situation, I feel, makes our kids insecure. And it makes the happening turn into a feedback loop. And then all of a sudden you have these situations happening all the time. And that's where I see a lot of toxicity in me and my son's relationship right now, is because him and I are stuck here. And so I've been trying to empathize with my boy more. And I badly want to just be able to patch our relationship and be able to be comfortable with each other. So I had to redirect majorly in one of his therapies this week. He's been doing this therapy called PCIT, which stands for Parent-Child Interaction Therapy. You get a headphone in your ear and you play with your kid, because play therapy is based around play, obviously. And the therapist can see you play, and there's all these metrics, and it's very structured, and you have to, and that's what helped me most of all, was having the structured playtime with O. And because I'm really bad at playing, and he really needs me to play with him. He needs it. It's like a food need. It's a hunger in him. He needs that time. And so having that structure was so helpful for us, and it was good for us. But when we graduated past that play part, we got into this obedience training stage. Every single parent thinks they want obedience. You feel like you want blind obedience. You want your child to listen immediately. And I've come to the recognition that it would simply be easier if all children were just blindly obedient. But we're not trying to raise little automatons or robots. Like, do you want a toaster, or do you want a free-thinking individual that could change the world or love somebody so deeply because of their convictions in it? And do you think any sort of that depth can come from just having pure obedience? So what started me thinking about this was talking with my therapist, but also a line from the Tao Te Ching, which I found just very enlightening. So I'm going to read it real quick. This is the bottom half of it, and I can't remember which chapter, but it has to do with how I feel and what I'm trying to do with my son and my redirection. So here it goes. So, when we lose the way, we find power. Losing power, we find goodness. Losing goodness, we find righteousness. Losing righteousness, we're left with obedience. Obedience to law is the dry husk of loyalty and faith. Opinion is the barren flower of the way, the beginning of ignorance. So great-minded people abide in the kernel and not the husk, in the fruit, not the flower, letting the one go and keeping the other. So there's Lao Tzu for you. So we've gone from having this implied miniature of ourselves that we subcontract to an ideal of who they are in our own heads. And when they don't match up with that, we shame them with questions. And from there, we get further angry when we don't have obedience. Is this the best way to treat a human being? If you were to flip sides, how would you feel if somebody only expected obedience from you and didn't want your opinions, and didn't care about your love? So I told this all to my son's therapist, which was very necessary. And I was immediately validated by her, which felt very good. She immediately said, well, see, I hired a consultant. We had all of our videos because I saw that it wasn't working. And she said, the consultant said that we should just quit, redirect. I told her, thank you. I feel that we were baking a cake without eggs, and that, you know, some sort of disciplinary model might be useful in the future, but the most important thing for my son and I right now is to work on our relationship. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to work on love. We're going to work on being together. I'm going to work on playing with him more and doing things with him more and not feeling personally vindicated by some adult action I think I see in his eyes or some adult feeling that he does not have the capacity to carry yet. I hope that somebody out there can relate to this, because it's so hard and it feels so lonely and isolating sometimes, especially if you're a single parent, especially if you're doing it all alone. These trials are impressive, and we are Atlas holding up a new small world upon our shoulders. Have faith in you and know that you are impressive and capable, and that you're going to be able to help them, that you have a beautiful creature. You are a beautiful creature. And even though your little creature who shines so brightly is not a mere copy of you, within their uniqueness, you could learn more about your own creature in it. So have faith in that and be love and love them and enjoy their time and love you. All right. Next, I want to read a little bit of Maladoma just because I like this little excerpt. And this is, he's trying to look at a tree. In his initiation, he's been tasked with seeing what the tree actually is. But he's been fighting it for days, and his worldly reasoning element, which is what I'm going to talk about right after this, has made it difficult for him to see things as they actually are. And this is him as he begins to see the spirit of the tree. Never before had I felt so much love. I felt as if I had missed her all my life, and I was grateful to heaven for having finally released her back to me. We knew each other, but at the time I could not tell why, when, or how. I also could not tell the nature of our love. It was not romantic or filial. It was a love that surpassed any known classification. Like two loved ones who had been apart for an unduly long period of time, we dashed toward each other and flung ourselves into each other's arms. The sensation of embracing her body blew my body into countless pieces, which became millions of conscious cells, all longing to reunite with the whole that was her. If they could not unite with her, it felt as if I could not live. Each one was adrift and in need of her to anchor itself back in place. There are no words to paint what it felt like to be in the hands of the Green Lady in the Black Veil. We exploded into each other in a cosmic contact that sent us floating adrift in the ether in countless intertwined forms. In the course of this baffling experience, I felt as if I were moving backwards in time and forward in space. While she had me in her embrace, the Green Lady spoke to me for a long time in the softest voice that ever was. She was so much taller than I was that I felt like a small boy in her powerful arms. She placed her lips close to my ear, and she spoke so softly and tenderly that nothing escaped my attention. I cried abundantly the whole time, not because what she told me was sad, but because every word produced an indescribable sensation of nostalgia and longing. Human beings are often unable to receive because we do not know what to ask for. We are sometimes unable to get what we need because we do not know what we want. If this was happiness that I felt, then no human could sustain the amount of well-being for even a day. You would have to be dead or changed into something capable of handling these unearthly feelings in order to live with them. The part in us that yearns for these kinds of feelings and experiences is not human. It does not know that it lives in a body that can withstand only a certain amount of this kind of experience at a time. If humans were to feel this way all the time, they would probably not be able to do anything other than shed tears of happiness for the rest of their lives, which in that case would be very short. Human beings never feel that they have enough of anything. Oftentimes, what we say we want is real in words only. If we ever understood the genuine desire of our hearts at any given moment, we might reconsider these things. We would quickly exhaust our weak arsenal of petty desires and discover with shame that all along we had been cheating ourselves. Love consumes its object voraciously. Consequently, we can only experience its shadow. Happiness does not last forever because we do not have the power to contain it. It has the appetite of a ferocious carnivore that has been starved for a long time. This is how much love and bliss and happiness there is in nature, in the place that was there before we existed in it. Powerful speaker. Highly encourage anybody who's a reader to go find his book. I'm reading from Of Water and Spirit, Ritual Magic and Initiation in the Life of an African Shaman by Maladoma Patrice Somme. So, what is spiritual seeing? What is perceiving something without words? What is not being used by hunger and desire? So, last night I was talking with a friend about this concept of abstraction. And even though dichotomy is a fallacy in most situations, abstraction, which could be related to this reasoning element of what it means to be human, our biology, our brain, our functioning element, has the ability to crunch and cognize. We can predict. When we see something, we can measure and we can assume and extrapolate sensory data. You know, in front of me now, I see all my clothing. I'm holding a lighter. That's sensory data. I'm in my closet. I'm sitting in front of you and I'm speaking. The words that are coming out of my mouth that I can hear reverberate off the walls are real. They're sense data. But human reason can take sensory data and we can think about it. We can run imagination chambers and we can hypothesize. And using these mental things, what's a good word for that? These mental mechanizations, you know, because it is a machine. It's a physical thing that causes all these thoughts. The brain is a physical element. But inside that space, which is incredibly powerful, you know, and that space piggybacks upon the thoughts and the abstractions of so many other humans going back into history for thousands of years. Our science and our philosophy is built upon all the other abstractions of all the other people before us. And when I begin to think about these things, to me, it feels like magic. It really does. Like that we can do this. Because what right does our machine, our being, have to be able to cognize? Because all these abstractions aren't real. They have no basis in reality. Even though we can take a prediction and we can implement reality, and a lot of the times it works, and that again makes it seem like magic to me. We can get to the moon that way. But there's this multi-level of knowing and seeing that we can do. And because of our humanness, I think a lot of us end up living in our abstractions. And even though it's powerful, and even though I'm not sure if any other creature has the ability to abstract like us, and though it's magic, it also seems to me to be madness because we have the ability to put ourselves into all these thought experiments and thought worlds. We can drive ourselves mad, and many do. But we can also have this way of knowing, which is kind of what Maladoma was doing, where we can just have the sensory data and we have that first initial impression on the tabula rasa that exists before our cognizing cruncher gets a hold of it in its teeth and is able to chew on it. So I want to talk about this more next week, but I call these two different bi-level of thinkings, abstraction on one side and intuition on the other. And intuition is instinctual to a degree. And I know that most other creatures have this attachment to intuition. Just it's all kinds of different intuitions. The intuition of an aardvark would be very different than me. But we have this ancient instinctual knowledge, and then we also have this pesky reasoning element that's perpetually putting things into its witch's soup pot and trying to alchemize and stir new situations into reality. So I'm going to be thinking about this. I hope you think about it a little bit too. And we'll get back to it next week. And we'll see what we feel. So thank you so much for being here. Odin's still asleep, so unfortunately he's not going to be with us to end the show. But I want you to know how important you are to me. This project means so much, and I want to help. I want to help you and others. I want you to be creative. I want you to feel empowered to be expressive, flamboyantly in your world. And I also want you to feel empowered to be loving towards yourself and have that self-care ritual that can bleed onto others so that you can love your world as much as I do. So, thank you. I'll see you next week.